Good morning and welcome to the Leadership and Insurance Podcast. I'm your host, Alex Bond, and I'm very lucky today to be joined in person, in the real, Tim Hardcastle, CEO of Instander. How are you?
I'm great. And how are you, Alex?
Yeah, I'm really good. I'm really good. It's quite interesting to do this cameras live in person. And this is FinPro Towers, not this office, but it's in the building. So you've really seen behind the veil. Nobody seems to see that ever.
It's great to see you in your natural habitat. You look very relaxed.
Thank you. Well, I'll try and keep it that way. Well, look, obviously we always start on the podcast that, you know, we can make some ill-fated attempt to explain Instander, but I think it's always better coming from the founder. So Tim, walk us through the Instander business and who you are.
Well, I'm the CEO and co-founder of Instander. We started, I guess we came to market about 8 years ago, mm-hmm. 2015. And I was brought into insurance through a bit of serendipity. I was headhunted and found a world of opportunity, complexity, diversity. And so I was fortunate to work with a great company when I was brought into insurance. And Instander was born out of this challenge of how do we address this multifaceted industry in a way that allowed people to innovate at speed, at the same time as having a secure, resilient, robust, scalable, modern technology that they could use to run their business on. Mm-hmm. Those two things are not happy bedfellows, or bed people, sorry, I should say.
Yeah, sure. So you still talk to this headhunter then, you don't blame them for anything?
Funny enough, they just reached out the other day. Really? So they mind giving them a plug, it's Heidrick & Struggles.
Strangely, we...
I applaud them for their CRM system, the fact that, you know, so many years on, they still knew who I was.
Well, that's very good of them. Yeah. That is their job. I spoke to the New York partner last week. Yeah. We had lunch together. So it's all very friendly in headhunting land. I think people think it isn't.
The particular calibre of Heidrick and Struggles people, you could drop them into a conflict of any description. They're great diplomacy ambassadors. So they did a great job on persuading me to join insurance.
Yeah, they're very good
and
people.
I have no regrets. Yeah,
they're very good people. I can't plug them too hard because they're allegedly a bit competitor, but we were playing very nice in New York. So and walk us through kind of where you are today, because we were just talking off air about founders, and I thought, let's pick that straight up, because I thought that was interesting. Yeah. You know, you had a very successful career before insurance and in insurance, could have taken that comfortable CIO money till retirement. Why didn't you? And why did you start to embark on this journey? Presumably because there's a problem to solve, but I suppose, what do you think about kind of founders' nature and what makes them different? Because you're choosing that challenging path when there are very good, very exciting, very comfortable jobs in the insurance market.
Well, that's a really good point and an observation. I think for me personally, if I trace some threads back to, you know, through my young adult period, mm-hmm. even into when I was at school and in the early days of education, I was classified as someone that was quite headstrong. I would put a slightly more benign interpretation, which is I was always a bit restless, always trying to look for how we could do things better. And mm-hmm. I think that served me really, really well in my corporate career, because I had a lot of responsibility at quite a young age, had very senior positions in different industries. And as you say, Hiscox, the insurer I got recruited into, was a great company. But I think ultimately, you reach a point, people have different inflection points, but for me, it was a recognition that I really did need to go and forge my own path. Mm-hmm. This restlessness, this desire to try and do something, it has antecedents years past, but I think I got to a certain point, maybe you could say it was a midlife crisis, because I was in my early 40s, and I could have stayed in Hiscox. They a great employer, it was a really rich environment, the salary was great, there was upside, but I wanted to take that step. And I think it was also fueled by a deep, deep frustration of technology was not working well in insurance, so those two things came together and converge, and then that's what spurred me on to, with my co-founder, set up Instander. And that passion, that drive has burnt bright then, it continues to burn bright. I have no look back moments.
Sure.
I think there's some real, and we can maybe probe into it a bit further about what, you know, at a deep level, what motivates people to set up a business, because it's not straightforward. We are not normal people that set up companies. I mean, you've got that experience yourself, Alex, right?
Yeah, I've done it several times. I mean, this is the most committed I've probably been. I think the midlife crisis, I was really smiling when you were saying that, because I was thinking I turned 40 last year. No, I didn't. I turned 41 last year. So you lose track, don't you? It hits 40, it kind of becomes an irrelevance. But it was that time to go, for me, it felt like now or never. It's like I'm really going to build this company and accelerate on. And that's, you know, thankfully what we're doing here with FinPro. But I think there was an obvious problem to solve. I found my comfort zone in terms of kind of where I wanted to play, which is insurance and insurtech space, and then that was the right timing.
If I may, I mean, look at what you're doing at FinPro. I mean, this is not a normal positioning in the market that you're in. Mm. You know, you've occupied, and very well, I must say, you've occupied a space around podcasts, sharing content, getting interesting interviews. And so you've put a particular different angle on your business, and that's you know, whenever you're setting up a company, and you're driven by something to do that, you need to bring something different, a little bit unique, and then you need to drive it as best you can and have the belief that that will succeed. And that was very much the same for us. You know, that belief that you will succeed is at times, and this is why I think the people that do start companies are not normal, because some of that belief is not going to be based on actual data.
No.
Because it doesn't exist necessarily. How will you know your company's going to be successful? In your case, you know people need to hire new people, that's clear, but it's very competitive. In our case, there was a lot of software companies in the market selling software successfully. So how do you know that you're going to be successful? You have to bring something different, you have to have a different angle on it, and then the belief that that angle, that differentiation you bring, will resonate with your ultimate buying market. And that belief's the thing that fuels you for the many hours, the many days, the many weeks, mm-hmm. the many months, in our case, many years, to go from nothing to, you know, much more larger enterprises, which is where we are now. Mm. But you need to be fueled by an internal engine, if you like. And I believe that that engine's got to have, be founded on this passion, this belief, as I talked about.
Yeah, and I think the thing that I would reflect on is your tolerance for risk. Mm. And I think about that more probably than anything. I kind of, my view is actually I blindly assume it's going to work, but then I worry about risk all the time. I.e. when it's going brilliantly, is the the team's celebrating, we've done a load of projects, it's completed, and then I'm sitting in the corner of the room going, well, it's all going to go wrong now.
I think you make a really good point, yeah. Right? There's a juxtaposition between the optimism and confidence that you need to have, which I think is belief, isn't, you know, that's part of belief, is knowing that, having this sense that you'll be successful. And the juxtaposition is, of course, you need to have, well, I think, a healthy a dose of paranoia, which is what happens if it doesn't work. Because, you know, in setting up a company, as any founder out there will know, you are living in the early days, you are living, breathing hand to mouth, and things can hit you and the business can skew sideways quite dramatically, and you're, you know, it's your thing that you've created and you've put the weeks, the months, the years into it.
Sure.
And so I think you summarize it well, that there's a juxtaposition between the confidence and optimism and the paranoia. And I share that. I mean, you know, it's probably only in the last few years that I sleep peacefully through the night.
Yeah, yeah.
As we've scaled, when people ask me what kept me awake, there was a lot of things to keep me awake.
Sure.
But I think ultimately your business, our business, and I think certainly for insurance, it needs, and I think you've done a podcast on this separately, it needs startup companies and insurtechs, because I absolutely firmly have the opinion that incumbents don't face the same pressures and opportunities to innovate as insurtechs do. And I think that's where you get this, you know, the under extreme pressure you form diamonds. I believe that a lot of insurtechs are diamonds. Not all of them will be, unfortunately. Some of them will fail, as we've seen in recent months here in the UK and in the US. But I think, you know, the industry needs us, because those slightly strange people like us, Alex, who set these companies up, yep. and have got the belief, you know, bring something to the market, as you do and as I do, that I think is needed. And as we've seen that, as we've scaled, you know, we've had that differentiation of people embrace it, and it brings value to them, and that's the key bit to unlock.
We were talking about R&D, and that's just kind of made my thought process. I've kind of got to this realization, this is my opinion, but my opinion is that, first, the insurance industry as a whole just needs to treat insurtech like externalized R&D. That's how I would treat it. Yeah. I think it's a sensible thing to do.
Yeah.
The scale of these organizations, carriers, or even large brokers, means that innovation is almost impossible at scale because you can't have 100% focus, you can't have 100% time. But I think more importantly, I make a sort of wider observation, and I won't get political, but it's tempting, that publicly traded companies are also almost impossible to innovate within unless it's at the core of their function. So if you're Google, that makes it a little bit easier. If you're a massive carrier in a regulated market, justifying some huge expense, which is a company-wide expense, to innovate around systems, whether you should or not is a different question as well, because you know you should probably spend your time being a good insurer. But your shareholders are not voting for that. So this is why I think this unique opposition, unique positioning of privately owned companies, or certainly venture-backed companies, or even PE-backed companies, in that kind of ability to kind of move quickly and innovate, is crucial and impossible in public market companies.
I think that's a really good point. There are some fundamental structural differences, I think, between a large carrier, which is, you know, again, antecedents from decades ago, where it's it may have been a very analog type company. It's built a brand, it's got millions of consumers as its market. It's trusted, it delivers a great service, but its antecedents are going to come from, you know, eons back, and it takes time to change process, and it takes even more time to change technology. So, and then their core business, to your point, is pricing risk, and then obviously settling claims when claims happen. And that core business does not lend itself to being highly innovative and highly driven to adopt some, let's say, some different practices when you've come from many, many decades back. So I think fundamentally carriers' core business is essential. They do it really, really well, otherwise they wouldn't be in business. But innovating in technology is very different. And then to add to that, when you're under the environment of a founder, you know, with bootstrapping or being backed, I would say it's actually equally demanding, but you know, you have no option but to be successful. Sure. And your core business, as you say, is the technology. Yeah. And having been a CIO in multiple industries as well as with Hiscox, I would argue all day long with any CIO from any carrier to argue that they would be able to build technology as well as a startup can. I think what they should be looking to do, and what I was looking to do when I was a CIO, and I would say to them, is be an assembler.
Yeah.
Right. So be an orchestrator. Leverage the technology that's around you, in modern technology like ours and others, and be the orchestrator, be the assembler, where you're combining those technology components to service the different market needs that you will have, because depending on the business you're in, you could be going direct to the consumer, or you could be going direct, you know, you could be going via a broker for commercial lines, not admitted in the US. But be the orchestrator of the technology that's around. Don't try and be a builder. Now, there might be some little bits of build element in doing the assembly, but in principle, you're not a builder of technology, you're an assembler or orchestrator of it. And we say that whether it's to the MGAs that we work with, and we are their core system, we are their system of record, or we say it to the larger carriers who are trying, as you say, to innovate, and they're looking at different slices of their company and how can we take them off and make them more digital. I would say exactly the same thing. You've got to be thinking about that role where you're sitting on top of technology capabilities. Because as you know, in your business, you know, there's lots of components to make businesses successful, and technology is a key one, but it's one of many facets. And so assembling and orchestration applies in other areas as well. I mean, process and people and brand management, etc.
I think that's the entrepreneur's journey as well, is that you, I think what it's done for me is it's given me a very simplistic view of what businesses are, in that I will, if we take that example, I am never going to be the best marketer, the best finance person, best operations person. In fact, it's very limited to kind of where my skills lie. And I think that's a good realization. Businesses should be the same, in that you're a carrier, you're very good at that.
Yep.
Do that. That's your USP, is your underwriting kind of view. Now, when we move into the world of kind of algorithmic trading, your algo, if you take the algorithm view, look at banking. Banking doesn't build technology. They might build different algorithms, but they use similar technology because they know that's where the kind of war is won. And I think for a long time, carriers are kind of trying to compete. And also, just from a talent perspective, because we're a talent business, if you look at who sits in an insurance business, most of the talent in those teams is actually about repairing and fixing and meshing components together. It's not R&D cutting edge engineers. And that's not a discredit, it's just a different skill set. I knew we'd do this, Tim. We've got a large portion of the business into the podcast, and we've not talked about any of the questions that we've had signed off by your team.
So I'm very happy to shoot the breeze. I think maybe the audience will be your guiders on whether we got that right or not.
But yeah,
I think you know, building on your point, if we can, before we want to
sure,
go back.
Sure, no.
I think the other really interesting thing, because I've been around and seen some of the big technology shifts over the last 10, 20 years, is the great news for the industry. So we can say, stick to your knitting kind of thing, stick to your core competencies, as Gary Hamel would have said in his book, and don't try and build technology, be the orchestrator. But the great news is, of course, the technology is so much more accessible, prevalent, and it's far more democratized than it was 10 years ago, so that you can be the assembler and you don't really have to have as many deep, deep domain skills as you used to. So, you know, the whole concept that Microsoft came up with a few years back around citizen developer was this whole point around making the technology accessible, giving it to people that know how to write the risks, know how to leverage other bits of ML and other parts of AI to create a risk assessment process that no one else has, but give them the tooling to do that. Don't try and build the tooling. Leverage it, orchestrate it, assemble it. And that democratization trend, I think we're seeing everywhere, in every form of technology. And you know, Microsoft and others have committed to that. And that's exactly what we anticipated, and one of our theses was when we were designing Instanda, was when I was at Hiscox, they did retail, they did specialty, they did even Lloyd's of London, insurance space satellites. How do you provide a single technology that can answer to all of those, you know, with all the distribution, different rate? You couldn't. I'd managed it, I'd seen it, I'd been in other industries and faced similar problems. So you have to democratize the technology to put it in the hands of the experts.
Sure.
And you'll find that in your business, right?
You
leverage bits of technology and it's very easy to use and it provides the value to you quite easily. And if it's SaaS-based, you only pay for what you use, principally. And if it's no good, you switch it off.
Sure.
Now, I know at scale, corporate systems, you can't switch them off. And that's another issue that maybe we'll get time for. You can invite me to back on another podcast. We'll talk about that, about, you know, getting rid of the legacy. But I think it's great time for more companies to embrace modern technologies and to leverage it for real value for their customers. So I think it's the best time to be where we're doing what we're doing.
I think so. And I'm going to end up ripping this up and throwing it away. We'll come back and do this one time. because I think you raise a really important point that we don't talk about enough. You know, you're talking about, you've got fundamental, in some places, core platform technology that you're offering to the insurance market. You've got a unique domain experience that if you're selling to you or and your colleagues. So
yeah.
How does one turn off a legacy system, go on to a kind of modern system? Because surely that is the prevention of anyone doing that. It's not because, you know, someone said, made a really good point on this podcast, and I apologise to whoever it was, and said, the people that know what's wrong and what's bad about insurance technology are the people working within it. It's not like, you can't approach them like they're naively pretending it's the best tech. So how does one make that shift? And realistically,
well,
how does it
happen?
I
think that's a really good question to ask. And I've got a few opinions, and I'd be really interested in the opinions of your audience. But let me share a couple of perspectives to back up my opinions on this. So having been in industry for 20 years before I co-founded Instanda, it gave me a really deep insight into the mechanics of how companies work. And I work for medium size and very large scale, FTSE 100 companies here in the UK with global footprints. And I was fortunate enough, including Hiscox, to be at a very senior level, in some cases at board level. So I got to see what the time I thought were, you know, executives who were being a little bit more cautious and risk averse than say I was as a 30, 40 something.
Sure.
And I think one has to recognize there is a deep rooted natural psychology of how boards make decisions. And I've seen it in multiple industries. And it's part of the board's remit. Their job is to represent and be the stewards for the investors, the owners of the company. And in that stewardship, they have to follow good governance, and their mandate is to be looking at risk management and mitigation of risk, right? So it's that is the thing that's, you know, dominated companies for many years, and it will continue to be so. Mm. But when they're looking at, and let's take technology as one of the slivers of success for any company, when they're looking at technology and technology strategy and where they should go next, their natural predisposition will be to say, well, let's try something familiar.
Yeah.
Let's try something that's proven. Let's try something that's been around for 20 years. And of course, that's a sensible strategy at one level, but on another level, what's happened in the last 20 years is that we've gone from analog, as we've mentioned before, to fully digital, where consumers have very, very different expectations of how they want to interact. Mm. And they want things to be frictionless and personalized. And so whatever our technology was designed and built 20 years ago or more will have been built with blinkers on around how this world was going to operate. They wouldn't have anticipated it. Mm. So you've got this board psychology which will naturally lean into and lend itself to technology that's been designed a long time ago, that's not as flexible and nowhere near as relevant for today's retail type environment, right? Mm. So then you've got that challenge, and then you have the insurtech community, as I said, which is exceptionally valuable for insurance. However, not many of them have succeeded or scaled to a point where a board of a large company could look at and say, this is a new modern company that I can trust and believe in.
Mm.
There are very few companies that have kind of broken through, if you like, into that layer of being confident partners. And so where we find ourselves, and there's one or two companies like us, is we have broken through the layer for some bigger companies, not for the tier ones.
Sure.
But it's an it's not a process that you can fast track, I don't believe. It's about, you know, growing a company like ours. We're like 180, 190 people now. We'll probably double that over the next 18 months. Double again. It's probably not until we're about 1,000 people or more that a tier one would start to look at us and say, okay, we might give them a shot compared to the incumbents,
mm-hmm.
Who are the ones that are designed 20, 25 years ago.
Sure.
And so this challenge, I think, is multidimensional. But I think, you know, the board psychology is a big factor for the bigger companies. Mm. And I don't blame them for it. We have to recognize it. We have to be open. And so then in answer to your question, that was a little bit longer answer.
No,
but getting rid of legacy and getting rid of core, you know, if when I was there as a CIO, and what I would be advocating now is you take it in parts.
Mm.
That old world of rip out and replace is too risky, too expensive. It would take too long. And there's some aspects that are just complicated for anybody, whether you're modern tech or old tech, but I would take it in slices.
Mm.
And there are some companies now in the UK that, there's one big one, I think, that has started to renew policies on the modern tech platform, and that's their way of getting off. So slowly renewing as you go.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is one option you could take.
Yeah, I've seen that, and there's a few things I'll unpick there. Firstly, I'll go back to the board mentality. I thought it was a really interesting point that, you know, they're stewards of the risk of the business, and I'm not risk in insurance sense, but just, you know, risk of the future of the business. But then one slice that gets ignored is that not innovating.
Mm.
And I think that the world's kind of waking up to that now.
Yeah.
And I think because we've seen such, you know, hugely successful businesses, you know, the Nokias of this world, the Blockbusters,
yeah.
that are, you know, Nokia still around, Blockbuster, ultimately don't exist.
Yeah.
You know, the Kodak moment that we always talk about. Innovation and not innovating has a huge price and a huge risk. I think that's kind of creeping into the boardroom, which is a positive thing. Not because I want them to not sleep at night, but I want them to be thinking about innovation in a way that they need to. And then that kind of, that new thinking of saying, right, why don't we look at net new business and put net new business on a new platform? And that's something that I've been talking about and advocating for a long time. And I'm surprised more businesses haven't gone, okay, we know, we almost have to ring fence this legacy business, but we can create, whether it's a new vehicle or a parallel vehicle, or even if it's just exactly the same as you said, it seems a smart way to go. But then obviously that presents a challenge for businesses like yours, in that we're saying that the road to success is long, it's expensive. Mm-hmm. And it kind of leads itself through 360 to saying the insurance industry as a whole kind of collaboratively needs to support businesses like yours, because where do we get that transition point? Yeah. Do we wait for the point of failure?
Well, there's a Darwinism effect, yeah, right, of companies starting up.
Of course.
Which is that if they have great product market fit and they're bringing value, they, most of the time, depending on management, depending on timing, they should succeed, mm-hmm, right? What I would say is it is a long, hard road. I don't think it makes any difference, particularly whether you're in the US or UK. The US, it's easier to access capital earlier, mm-hmm, than it is in the UK. But I think there's still the same attributes of success will hold. What's interesting for me is, having been on this journey, and you, as you say, Alex, we can share the difficulties of doing this kind of thing for several years, is that we're starting to reach an inflection point where now, having been through the growth trajectory that we've been through and having raised the money that we have, the bigger corporates are now finally starting to look at us, and maybe it's a bit of a convergence between pressure on them to innovate, concerns around not being able to leverage other technologies like AI and ML, mm-hmm, because their core systems aren't designed for it, etc. And so how do they access into this modern technology? But even I would say that for us, we've had to get to a certain scale, presence and size for the larger companies to get past those initial psychological barriers.
Sure.
12, 18 months ago, we weren't having anywhere near the same kind of strategic, qualitative conversations that we are now with a number of much bigger carriers. Mm. And I think that's just symptomatic of the journey that we've been on and the scale that we've reached, mm, which I'm really pleased about, but I'm a bit frustrated that maybe those conversations could have started earlier.
Sure.
We could have added more value to these companies. They could have had more benefit. But it's, as I said, there's some of that psychology about how big are you and are you credible and reliable?
Yeah, I mean, it really resonates with me. I mean, going back to your conversation about when we were talking about Heidrick & Struggles, when I first started working in search, and you know, I started in contingent recruitment and then I moved into search, and well, that's a difficult journey in itself, because mm-hmm, there's a new way of working, there's, yeah, a new kind of level of care required. But you know, we were a scrappy startup search firm. I was like employee number 25, and we'd go in the room and we'd pitch and we'd do well, and they'd go, we like what you've got to say, but essentially we'd always go, no one ever gets fired for hiring Heidrick or Korn Ferry, yeah, or, yeah, you know, and that's completely true at that level. And then echoing your point, we actually just came back from the conference, New York conference, ITI, and we'd said it was really interesting in that this is probably 3 years in its kind of current form as FinPro. The conversations we're having at the last conference were, we were being sought out. We were, yes, being sought out by slightly bigger players at, yes, later stage insurtechs for slightly more significant roles. And, you know, a lot of our partners in the past were seed Series A, mm-hmm, and we were their first hire, and we loved working with them. And it was very reciprocal, because we were very early, mm-hmm, they were very early, and, yeah, we're all in it together. Now there's just a little bit more meat on the bone. And there's of course, there's a little bit of a stack of evidence to say, look, we can do this. And like yourselves, there's a stack of evidence that just accumulates over time that pushes over. And then you start to have those conversations. But you've got to kind of see it out. And I wanted to talk about...
Well, can I build on, please, that point, if I may, as well? I suspect, and you can challenge me back if I'm not... This hunch. But I think you get sought out, I would suggest, by those companies that see you and what you do and the podcast as really quite forward-thinking. You're really immersed in the industry. You've got an opinion. Mm-hmm. You're bringing in people to talk to them about their opinions. And they would value that form of what I would call indirect expertise. Mm-hmm. It's not direct for how I can hire a candidate. But it's a differentiator, as I said earlier, between around you and some of the other search firms. And so they will seek you out. But the companies that seek you out, right, I would suggest, are probably slightly more progressive, mm-hmm, and what you're doing resonates with them. And that's the same for us. So, you know, our journey has been with, if I go 4 or 5 years back, we were working with much smaller organizations, the startups, the MGAs that were trying to get going. And we would be very empathetic because we'd understand what they were trying to achieve, because a number of us are former insurance executives. But also, we could empathise from the fact we were building a business like they were.
Sure.
And so there's a very, happy conversation that you can have. As we've grown, we still see that theme thematically coming. We will not necessarily be approached by very conservative carriers. We'll be approached by those that are really trying to do something different, really want to tackle their cost base, really want to engage in a more personalised offering to the market. And so I think you end up attracting from the market some of those things that you're trying to differentiate yourself around and what you represent. And you can only represent yourself in a certain way. You can't be all things to all people.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, yeah.
So you have to, again, back to the beginning of what do you find your business, what are you founding your business on? What's the purpose and what are you driving towards? That, I believe, if you stay true to it, you really believe it as you have to as a founder, then that will resonate and that will create your brand and positioning in the market, and that will attract certain kinds of people that resonates with. It's not going to be everyone, and so I'm really, really feel privileged that we end up working with probably the most progressive segments of the insurance industry, whether it's the segment of the large carrier who wants to do something really difficult, different, or the MGA that's trying to get going. And I love that.
Yeah.
Because then we get to see the very best, I think, of insurance.
Yeah, I would agree with you. And obviously I would. It's sort of... But I think it took me a long time. And I think this is a maturity of self, maturity of business, to realise that, one, you can't be all things to all people. Mm-hmm. Secondly, there's nothing good about that either, because then you tend to be offering nothing. But I felt very welcome in the world of InsurTech in a way that I never quite did in insurance. Insurance is a very welcoming place. I had lots of friends in insurance. I worked in insurance for 17 years now. Mm. But that kind of innovator, I think I started to look around the room, and I think it's this entrepreneurial thing. I went, oh, these people think a little bit closer to how I think.
Yes.
And that's bad, because I have to be careful that I'm going, oh, this is groupthink, this is great. But we found our home with these people. I think we shared values about kind of what was important and just trying to do things different. You know, there's a value in trying to do things. When I started a podcast, I didn't think I'd be sitting on 160 episodes in, sitting on a sofa. I was in my room during lockdown and barely had any lighting, I think.
Yeah, but you were prepared to take the step and to try it.
100%. And
back it, and you look how successful you've been.
Yeah, and I think it's just a good analogy for I want to tell you a story actually about bringing your whole self to work, because it kind of plays into that. That I used to sort of pretend to play golf. Mm. I do play golf, I just play it very badly.
Well, don't we all?
No, exactly. I think most people do.
Most people do.
But I never forget, I was pitching for a search from a very established, very traditional reinsurance business. It was going very well. We'd given them a nod. We'd done some work with them before. We thought we'd win it. And this is in my previous guise. Then we sort of broke out from the kind of work conversation into kind of pastimes. And you know, I said many times, I trained as an actor, and I like to do kind of theatre, and I'd won a part in a play. Been talking about golf, been talking about how much this kind of reinsurance guy went and played golf all the time. And then as soon as I said I was in a play, got very serious and was like, are you going to have any time to commit to this assignment? I thought, you wouldn't ask me that if I was saying I'm a semi-professional golfer. But as soon as it was this kind of slightly out of the ordinary hobby, which is not that unusual a hobby, but it was like, oh, you don't have enough time for it. So it was really interesting, because there's this clash of cultures there. And that always resonates with me about, one, you've got to find your tribe, but also it can be very guilty in insurance of going, everyone's a bit identikit if you're not careful. You know, everyone goes to the sevens, everyone plays golf, everyone goes to certain trips and others.
Well, that's what I mean at the beginning. I mean, about being a founder is you will be thinking differently, because otherwise you're not bringing anything to market that's going to be of interest, because it's same. But in thinking differently, you have to embrace a kind of a diversity and be prepared for ambiguity, right? Because whenever you're trying something new and different, as I said earlier, it's not guaranteed it will succeed. You have to have the optimism and confidence that it will, but there's an ambiguity with what you're doing, because there's inflection points about whether it will be successful or not. And I think, again, psychology of very successful companies in insurance so far, risk management, being conservative, is that ambiguity is not something that they would be embracing. But we're in a world now, and we don't need to look very far, do we, whether it ranges from, you know, the rise of fake news, whether it, whether you look at the deep impact in which AI is going to be impacting us all on video, on text, on voice, and so on. We're in a world of a lot more uncertainty and a lot more less predictable. And therefore, if there was now a time to be embracing a bit more ambiguity and doing things differently, again, I would say it's now. Mm-hmm. So as the, you know, the founders amongst the insurance industry, I think the timing for them that are successful is really good, because I think most executives on any board will be looking at the challenges in front of them, and they do look different.
Sure.
They do look different to how they looked 5 or 10 years ago. Now, if they come to the party and want to work with innovative companies like yourselves, like us, that's great. If they don't, then again, my thesis on that is they will not be a winner in the medium term. They just won't.
No, I completely agree. I wanted to move on to the question of, he had a pretty significant raise about a year ago. Was it Series B, I think, was that?
No, it's it was called a Series B, but it was just a raise.
Just a raise.
It was a raise that we a raise to the point where we don't need to raise again.
Fine. I mean, I was actually having a conversation.
That's quite fundamental, because I think, you know, looking at the, again, part of the structural model around how do insurtechs grow, then they, many of them have been living on going from one fundraise to the next within 18 months, 24 months. And I think, unfortunately, a lot of them have hit the buffers as capital markets have retreated, and they've focused on, you know, the more fundamentals of business around profitability and cash flow. Whereas we set ourselves up with those fundamentals in mind, so our raise was done with Tosca, who I'm absolutely delighted about as a partner, and we, those fundamentals of profitability and cash were built in. So it was a raise.
So old fashioned.
I know. It was a raise that we did, and we didn't have to do another. We don't have to do another raise again.
That is important to draw that distinction.
Yeah, it is.
Funnily enough, I think the rounds are quite interesting, because I've just talking to a founder just before you turned up, and I was going, is it a seed? He was like, I don't know, Alex. It's just the amount of money I need to sort of make the business get to where I need to go.
To the next stage, right?
But do you think that, one, do you think this round-to-round thing is predominantly an American preoccupation? Because it tends to be how businesses are growing, because it's a slightly different funding environment, certainly much earlier stage funding environment. And then double part of the question, everyone I speak to that has that viewpoint and said, well, I always thought about these fundamentals before, is either a serial entrepreneur or bootstrap their own company. I think everyone should bootstrap, even if it's for a...
Yes, I agree.
I know that's very difficult to do in certain instances, but I'm surely you can bootstrap to a point, even if it's to get some semblance of piece of software.
We bootstrapped for 5 years.
Yeah.
We're a bit unusual in that respect, but I think we were driven back to my earlier points around an absolute fundamental belief in what we were doing. And if we weren't going to back ourselves with our own, not just sweat capital, but actual personal. I mean, we weren't wealthy individuals, you know, relatively modest by general standards, but we were prepared to put our houses on the line and raise capital on the back of, you know, if it didn't succeed, we would have lost our homes.
Sure.
And that if you're not in the position where you're prepared to back absolutely everything into the endeavor, then how can you ask any external finance provider to do the same? Mm-hmm. I mean, I know it's corporate money, let's say, and they have their LPs and the money will be distant, but I'm absolutely agreement with you. I think if you're not prepared to back yourself emotionally and financially, then really you've got to think more seriously about what your idea is.
I think the other thing is you get the scars, you make the mistakes, and those mistakes really cost. And I'm very... An anecdotal story I will tell is I was talking to a VC, quite a prominent one, and they were talking about someone that had just raised money, and they went, oh great, they raised a load of money last time. They lost a load of money. And the story on the pitch, and they sat in on the pitch, and they said the pitch was, oh, we've learnt a load of lessons. Good, and I don't want to demonise people for trying and failing, because that just happens, and sometimes you don't succeed in business and you fail, and that happens more often than not. But it was kind of the conversation we were having, was like, how deep do you learn those lessons, really, if it doesn't cost you anything? Because it really doesn't cost you anything. So I think there's a danger, but I think that danger has not passed entirely, but the funding environment is different now. And so, therefore, I kind of think there's a positive in that good fundamentals are back in fashion again.
Well, that's why we did our raise. Mm. We had a term sheet before the InsurTech collapse, and we completed our raise after the InsurTech collapse.
Sure.
And Tosca were good to their word on the term sheet, which was issued pre-collapse. And so the relationship with ourselves and Tosca is a very strong one, but they acted with utmost integrity. But I think they were able to act with integrity because the fundamentals of our business were sound and were actually directionally exactly what is now going to play out, what is now playing out when startups are trying to go for fundraising now.
Mm.
I think what happened, unfortunately, for a number of founders, they got carried away on the wave of you can have a multiple of ARR of, you know, 15, 20, 25 times or beyond, and just keep raising money for an 18, 20 more month window. And it'll all come good at some point in the future.
Sure.
In Never Never Land.
Yeah.
And we didn't think about it that way, because back to your point, we bootstrapped, and then we knew how much we needed. We had a period of time where we needed some funding, and then we would be washing our own face as a business, which is exactly the plan.
Mm.
And so I think those fundamentals they should never have gone away, but I think the industry, both the VC industry and the InsurTech side, lost sight of it, and they shouldn't have done.
Sure. I'm going to have to finish on one question, because otherwise we're going to dramatically... Because we're in person, we actually have got a person giving us you're running out of time. Yeah, absolutely. So, but I did want to ask you about expansion, because I think the US is the obvious place to go, and one would expect you to go there. But you've also expanding into Japan as well.
Mm.
So, is that driven by sort of inbound inquiries to the business, or strategically be good to explore kind of why specifically that territory next?
Yeah, that's a good. Well, briefly, we haven't just looked across the pond, so to speak, at the US, and it's obviously the market size of the US is much bigger than UK. It's about equivalent to Europe. We've been in the US for 6 years now.
Yeah.
We've just done it very slowly and very quietly, and again, in this model of funding it, backing ourselves in a modest way. So we do understand the US market. We see there's great opportunities for us there. We have nearly 30 clients there now, so it's been built over a period of time. And we can see there's in the short to medium term great opportunities for us. Japan was different. We got invited into Japan by a partner that said, don't worry, we'll take care of everything. We just think the technology that you offer, there is nothing like it in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
We haven't seen anything else that's available that democratizes technology, allows this agility to innovate. So we'll bring you into the market, because it wasn't a market that we identified as the most... the one that we could get a good return on over a medium period of time. So we allowed that partner to take us in. And then unfortunately, we won our first client, and then there was an audit conflict with the partner, so they couldn't implement. So we ended up having to stand up a team to go and implement in Japan. And now, a little bit of time later on, we're still working with that partner. We have some other clients there. And I think it's a fascinating market. They do business in a very different way to the US and UK. There's lessons to be learned across all three core markets. But I think it's going to be a slower growth trajectory in Japan, but I think it's a very long-term potential growth area for us, yeah.
Well, we've said it's a long-term game, so it's kind of theme of the day. We haven't covered hardly any of the questions, but I've really enjoyed that. There's such a big deep dive into entrepreneurship.
It's been a pleasure
to
talk to you.
But thank you so much for being a guest on the podcast.
Pleasure. Good to talk to you, Alex.
Thanks, Tim.